What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we are celebrating our 200th episode. Can you believe it,
Sherlyn? I'm old.
We've rebooted the Engadget Podcast. This is, I think, the actual third iteration of the podcast, but we've hit 200 episodes. That's a pretty big milestone. So we will be talking about some of the, you know, some of the notable guests we've had on, some of the topics that have changed a lot since we launched in... we'll look back. That was fall 2019, the last good times before pandemic life. So a lot has changed since we started this podcast. But I do want to say it's been a lot of fun with Sherlyn, our producer Ben, and all the guests we've had on. Also with you, audience. So thank you all so much for joining us. And for the folks who joined us for the live streams when we had those, still looking into bringing those back. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a review on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice, and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Okay, Sherlyn, to celebrate our 200th episode, we're also bringing on Engadget senior writer Sam Rutherford. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Also joining us today is podcast producer Ben Ellman. Hey, Ben.
Hey, always glad to be here.
I think we've had a lot of fun conversations with you, Sam. So you're a good addition to this whole conversation.
Were you ever a fan of the Engadget podcast before you joined Engadget? Whatever iteration it was.
Really putting him on the spot, Sherlyn. Wow.
I would tune in every once in a while. Like, I only have space in my life for a certain amount of podcasts. And for me, a lot of times, like, podcasts are like, that's when I use, like, checking on, like, basketball or, like, other stuff. But because I've known, like, you know, I've seen you guys around so long and I've, like, you know, familiar with so many people that we see in every day, they're like, hey, you guys tell me this, so like, you're going to have a good episode? Yeah, I'll be on. You tell me Fisher's going to, you know, going to be on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll tune in for those. There's only so much rehashing that, like, I think everybody wants to do. So it's like,
especially if you're in the industry, there's only so much you can, like, keep hearing over and over again. I do not blame anybody, like, in my real life for not actually listening to the podcast. My wife doesn't listen to the thousands of podcasts I've made for a very long time. You know, it's a thing. But the fans, the true fans, are right here with us. And
they're my favorites.
They're your favorites. We started this podcast, or this iteration of the Engadget podcast, in fall of 2019, right after some major Microsoft news, I believe. And a lot has changed since then. But we wanted to highlight some of the big things that I think has changed a lot, because it's not just the pandemic. It is like tech itself has kind of reformed itself, right, Sherlyn?
I wanted to say before we get into, like, you know, recapping how much has changed and everything, can we just, like, I have these, like, almost traumatic flashbacks to the first episode recording, because I was traveling. I think I was at, like, Google I/O or something, or for Microsoft. I can't remember what I was traveling for, but as in a hotel. And I remember the recording that I sent over to Ben eventually somehow was not coming from the mic that I had connected. So that very first episode we put out just sounded awful on my end. And I caught so much heat for it.
Episode zero, from listeners. You know?
It wasn't like the real episode probably. But I never made that mistake again. So yeah, there's a lot, like, if you look back on the year since we first launched or relaunched this version of the podcast, there's a lot that happened. But I think we've like agreed on a few themes. And I think at the top of everyone's mind is for sure AI. And like I said, generative AI more than anything, has really kind of made its way into the mainstream conversation. Dev, you've been covering it, at least from the Microsoft side of things. Do you want to, like, talk about some of your biggest takeaways?
Sure. I mean, you were also there, Sherlyn. You were at the Bing chat launch, you know. That was the big thing, though. That was like the tipping point where everyone was like, oh, we were seeing stuff from ChatGPT. We were hearing about OpenAI for years. Then Microsoft was like, hey, we're going to make Bing useful. And everybody suddenly started paying attention. And we were also like, Bing of all things. But yeah, that kind of marked Microsoft's big, march towards integrating AI everywhere. They had already launched a Copilot for some of their coding stuff, some of their developer tools before this. But now we are at a point where Copilot, they have launched Copilots for Office 365, for all sorts of stuff. They were going to launch a standard just Windows Copilot. Now it's just all kind of unified as Copilot, which is a new feature in Windows 11. That lets you tap into all the stuff you were going to do with Bing Chat, so you can ask it queries, you can have it summarize a web page or summarize a document or something. It is now built into Windows, and Microsoft is now leaning on it. I feel it's like the main thing, you know, for Windows. Like, it is, you don't normally see Microsoft of all companies make a big leap and just like, oh, we're abandoning the way you normally use a computer. And here's this new thing. And we have spent over $10 billion investing in it. Please, please like it. Please use it. I think it's a little desperate. I think it's a little weird. And as we've talked about on this show, I think it reminds me of when Microsoft was like, they looked around, they saw the iPad was becoming a big thing. And they were like, okay, Windows is now a tablet operating system. The start menu is dead. Here is the start page. And everybody went boo. You know, just like a wholesale rejection of that idea. And they had to like really back away from that. They can't really back away from the AI stuff because they have spent so much money on it. It is now going to be a core part of Windows, you know, Windows 11. There are rumors that Windows 12, whatever that looks like, could actually be launching in the middle of next year. And I assume that's going to have even more AI integration. So, you know, yeah, everything is AI now. But I think for Microsoft, more than any other company, especially after Nadella had to jump in after all the OpenAI stuff, it's such a big deal. It's kind of astounding. Like, Microsoft is fundamentally an AI software company now.
I don't know that, like, years ago I would have been like, yeah, Microsoft is an AI company. I can say that, like, Google, for sure, I'm not surprised it's an AI company. I'm sure that, like, and I think they have the prowess too. But I still don't think, for me anyway, that, like, AI, the way it's taken off this year, has really featured that heavily in my life. I mean, Sam, I feel like you and I are a lot more similar in that our lives are more gadget-oriented than software focus. Has AI featured heavily in your life lately?
Not so much. And then that's kind of the thing, is that, like, we're in this weird nebulous period where, like, people talk a big game about AI, but how much do you actually use it in your life? And the really big struggle is figuring out what might actually be useful that AI can do that you want to use. And so, like, you know, for me, that the first time I was like really opened my eyes, like, you know, going past, like, you know, Google Assistant, from which has been out for a while, was like really this year on the Pixel 8, where they have the Magic Editor, because it made just editing photos on my phone a lot easier and more powerful than I was ever, like, you know, expecting it to be. And that's like one very small tangible example, but like, people talk so much about AI and what it can do, and it's like, we're still at that point where it's like, you know, it's like more of an idea. It's like having like a weak brainstorming friend than like having something that can actually do tangible things for you on an everyday basis.
I still like asking for like spec comparisons, even though I still have to go and double check them. But if I'm like, give me a table of the Galaxy S23 versus the 22, just so I can like look at it real quickly, that is helpful, even though it takes a little while for it to generate it. It's also worth pointing out, like, the gadgets we review, the gadgets we talk about, have all been like leaning into AI for a while. All the Google like photo stuff, all their night photography stuff, like, those are leaning on computer vision and AI in different ways. But now it's just like, it's a thing. It's a like a search bar where you can actually talk to AI and use it in like a direct way. And that is the very new thing. And you can have it create images. Yeah.
I agree that the generative aspect of it makes AI seem a little bit more like what people imagine AI to be. Whereas like AI before generative AI, to me, was just algorithms. To me, it was just like, oh, predicting what you might do and then doing it before you, like a little bit more like just predictive algorithms. Whereas like generative AI seems a bit more like wormy. And to be clear too, I think for the three of us, and I've said this in previous episodes too, like for the three of us specifically, being writers ourselves, we don't rely on things like ChatGPT as much to like come up with emails for us, come up with like essays for us. But other people for whom like writing is a big part of their jobs, but they don't like it as much, they have, I think, started to rely so much more on
ChatGPT. Didn't choose this life, we did.
To your point, like, I think, you know, if you're like a kid in school and like, you know, say you have to come up with a project where you're talking about, oh, describe like your perfect day and you want some imagery to like put on a poster board. If you're asking AI to like, hey, make, you know, paint me a picture of a sunny day with clouds and like a nice field, and you're 8 years old or 9 years old and you can't draw that well, suddenly, like, you know, that could be a really interesting application. But once again, you know, we're talking about a children's, you know, school project, not something that's going to necessarily change the world on a grand scale.
And this is where I start to get worried, too, because as we lean into AI to do these things that we are not, maybe just not very good at, if you're not good at writing long emails or documents or something, it can be helpful. But at the same time, you get good at things that you're not good at by doing them. And if you're like tapping into the AI to do all this stuff, like, is this just like, we're going to have a whole generation of folks who aren't actually building that writing muscle in their brains because they're just leaning on the AI for all that stuff? I think that's fundamentally more harmful than like, okay, calculators are a thing and people aren't doing more math in their heads. But I also think being able to construct sentences and ideas is a little more, you need to use that every day. You need to like sit down and like collect your ideas and communicate them to people properly. That's my worry, but I guess we'll see what happens. You know, it's just one of those things I'm terrified of.
I think one thing I was not expecting to see, I don't think I expected generative AI at all when like thinking back to that traumatic incident where I was recording our first episode, right? But like, I wasn't expecting generative AI, but I all the more was not expecting you could enter a prompt and have an image generated that would have like 17 fingers and like 300 teeth. You know what I mean? Like just that sort of weird imagery coming out of AI was just funny and unexpected for me. But I can also see like maybe another 200 episodes down the road where like AI has become so much better that like it is so important to talk about like, you know, AI ethics and how are we like properly labeling images generated by AI. And that is a beginning conversation right now. I'd be curious to see like another 100 or 200 episodes down, like what that
I mean,
looks
that's
like.
Already happening. Like I saw a bunch of pictures on Instagram of Steve Harvey as the singer of a hardcore punk band, and he didn't have 17 fingers. It looked like a surprisingly good image. And I think that's going to be where a lot of the societal impact from generative AI is going to come. We are such a visual society that eventually some AI-generated image is going to break through. People are going to think that it's real, and we're going to have to deal with the fallout from that.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that serious, but there's that image of the Pope, remember? When he was, like, blinged out wearing that awesome jacket, and it's like, yo, but Pope's outfit is looking pretty fly right now. And it's like, oh, okay. It just turns out AI was messing with us.
My other worry is video, because we're just talking about images, but we are seeing the deepfakes are going to be bad. We're also just seeing demos of AI, generative AI video solutions right now. And it's a little scary because it's looking real. And at the same time, like all the stuff, we don't know where it's getting the source material from too. So I think we really have to shift the conversation away from being like generative AI being this magic box that can produce anything you want to being like it is remixing all the information it has illegally absorbed. You know, it has absorbed copyright information, stuff from artists, didn't have to pay a dime. Like these companies didn't have to pay for that. But now OpenAI can charge you a monthly fee to get higher levels of ChatGPT. It's weird to get like material that's basically been chewed up and then spit back out at you. And now you're paying for the privilege of getting it because it looks nice. You know, I think we really need to think about that. We're going to keep talking about the AI stuff, folks, but I feel like we have to hit another one of these big ones. Like Sherlyn, Sam, anything you want to call out? Because there are a couple of big topics that have certainly changed a lot.
I have a couple of small topics. One is, we don't talk about cryptocurrency a lot, and not that we should, but if you look at back, the price of Bitcoin in 2019 was $3,000. And as you know, as we're talking right now, Bitcoin's kind of in a run up back to, you know, it's at what, 40,000 right now. And, you know, that's still down from an all-time high of 60. But I think this is one of those things that like I honestly have no idea where it's gonna go or what the trajectory for crypto is in general. And that's one of those things. And then as a tangent to that, NFTs were not a thing 4 years ago, really, that people talked about. Still not a thing, but they had, you know, they had this one hype moment, you know, not that long ago, and then it disappeared, and who knows where that's going to.
I think if we're going to pat ourselves on the back just a little bit, I do think it is important in the tech industry is to like look at something and be like, you have no clothes on. Whatever you are, whatever people are selling to make money is like, clearly you're not providing value. So we never really covered NFTs much until like there were some big crashes. We never really spent much attention on Web3 stuff because I saw a lot of that stuff as like marketing garbage from people who are trying to make money and not actually produce anything of value. But go ahead, Cher.
To be clear, Engadget did cover some NFT stuff, but we always did so with like a healthy dose of skepticism. Like incredibly like, oh, look at this. What was that website that dropped NFTs? Not StockX. Was it StockX?
Oh, OpenSea.
Yeah, all the Nike, all the like NBA tie-ins. A lot of breathless reporting around like how awesome this was all going to be. And we're like, no, this is dumb. And thank God we were right. Imagine thank if God. We were wrong, though.
No, I mean, I had full faith that those freaking Bored Apes. We are now in a world where the Bored Apes people have lost a lot of money, millions of dollars, it seems. But also there was a Bored Apes event recently. And a lot of people were, I feel bad. Because a lot of people were apparently slightly blinded at the event because they used like UV lights, like cleaning lights for the stage, like sanitizing lights. And you're not supposed to look at those, folks. So they had some vision problems the next day. But I don't know. There's a metaphor in there somewhere.
There's so much about like the crypto NFT space that feels like that quote from Firefest, let's just do it and be legends.
I feel like there's a theme and I want to touch on it, but I want to also just hear, because Sam, you said crypto and NFTs were like what your one thing, and but they were part of like a couple of things you had thought about. Do you want to go ahead first before?
Oh, no, they're just kind of a joint, you know, those two things are kind of linked, and they're, you know, to me, they're just like in a space where I have literally no idea what could happen with the future of Bitcoin and crypto in general. And, you know, in theory, there is something to like the idea of like, hey, you have digital ownership of a certain piece of art, like an NFT, but the way it was handled, like Devinder said, it was just like, it felt exploitive, and it didn't make sense in the way that people were talking about it.
It was exactly the way rich people think of art. And weirdly enough, the movie Tenet kind of explored some of that. It's like art is never something rich people look at in terms of like aesthetics. They buy it because it can be worth more. You spend, you know, $1 million on a painting because you hope it's worth $10 million in a couple of years, but they'll store it somewhere and never like actually look at it. And that was immediately the market that was being shaped up by NFT stuff, and then literally JPEGs and stuff of no value. So anyway, do we have anything else to say on these things? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it wraps up very nicely in this thing I was thinking about, which is it falls under a theme of how in the last few years since we relaunched, I've seen this sort of recurring instances or like pattern of people just taking something, running extremely wild with no checks and balances, and then getting in trouble. So we've got like, yeah, NFTs or whatever, and these events. And then which was that bank, the Silicon Valley Bank, that was just like, yeah,
that was a whole,
wasn't
separate
it just
thing.
People who
that
were was, running yeah, around with no adults bad. In the room? Wasn't that, I just felt like no, yeah, but I mean, feel like no adults in the room was a theme that kept recurring in the last few years. I was like, oh yeah, of course this didn't go anywhere. You are dumb.
Did it start with Facebook? Like, did it start with like the all like, look at these young geniuses. Let's let them do whatever they want. Doesn't matter if their businesses aren't turning a profit. We're like, right, like investors will give them money to hopefully get a 10x or more return in a couple of years. And yeah, it's all kind of falling apart right now. So.
Really quick shout out to Zuckerberg, who in the last few years seems to have grown up a little bit too. So
I don't know if that's true.
I don't know. He seems like, yeah, I think, so like, who knows?
We can have a whole separate episode about this. I think he has gotten a really good, he feels better himself. Like, he feels better about himself, attitude wise. I think he may have a life coach. He may have getting more like, help in general in terms of seeing perspective. But I think also a lot of that comes from dismissing all the bad stuff he has done and just like moving forward and being like, we talked about this. He's very into fun. Let's just have fun, guys. Let's not think about the influences.
And who's fun? I think that's and it. Whose like, fun is stepping on who else's toes?
Right now, his fun is like, I think generally fun. Like when he's talked about some of the meta stuff and it's like, yeah, well, he's building a world where we can all have more fun and have a good time. But it's also a weird pitch when Facebook itself is the cause of like a democracy being destabilized in several countries. Like, yeah, it's deeply annoying, but clearly Zuckerberg has gotten a lot of like, I don't know, his perspective just seems a lot brighter. One thing I wanted to bring up, Sherlyn and Sam, you guys are actually the perfect ones for this, is foldables. We were talking so much about foldable phones when we started the podcast. I was skeptical then. I'm a little less skeptical now, but certainly not to the point where I kind of want to run out and get one. But how do you guys think that foldable market has gone? Because I think we launched like when the first Galaxy Fold, something around the first Galaxy Fold launch, something was happening.
I almost think that back in 2019, we were like seeing the prototypes. Sam will know better. Sam, even like you main the foldable phone. You should tell us more about this.
Yeah, I believe, unless I'm mistaken, that the original Galaxy Fold came out in 2019. And so, you know, it's been...
Yeah, I'm looking it up. September 6th, 2019. That's the first Galaxy Fold.
And so
yeah.
I think as someone who's excited by, you know, flexible display technology, there's like two ways of looking at it, right? There's the people think that every phone is going to be flexible at some point. And I've never been of that mindset. But, you know, I think... just from my perspective, you know, I go outside and I notice that, like, I just see more people with foldable phones now. Like, when I went to the auto show in the spring, one of the people who was, like, you know, handing out badges, she had a foldable phone. I had a plumber come by and fix a pipe in my house. That guy had a foldable phone. And so we're seeing not just, like, you know, weird nerds like us have foldable phones. We're seeing them, like, just regular people have these devices.
Speak for yourself, Sam.
Yeah. And so, like I said, I don't think, you know, foldable phones, at least in the near term, are going to be the dominant market for smartphones or whatever, or tablets for that matter. But, you know, seeing that, like, hey, maybe 5%, 10%, and maybe eventually we settle on something like 25% of the market will be foldable devices, I think we're just kind of seeing that slow progression. And it is definitely, like, you know, a maturation process. It's not just, like, an overnight switch, and that was never going to happen.
Well, I mean, when we launched, so let's just, like, flash back a little bit. That first Galaxy Fold was a disaster, like an absolute disaster, and we were basically starting the podcast, like, when that was all launching, as, like, that thing was a beta product. It was very expensive. The screen could peel off easily because people thought, yeah, that top layer was just a screen protector and it wasn't. Dust was getting trapped in. Like, it didn't, Samsung, it took like 6 months for the second Galaxy Fold to hit because they immediately wanted to get that first one off the market. I'm right there with you, Sam. Like, I see, I'm in New York right now doing some meetings for CES, hanging out with Sam and Sherlyn. And when I'm on the train, I see people with foldables and I see people watching movies and doing big screen stuff. But I also see, like, I saw somebody watching like a really nice looking movie and on their foldable, just like that crease in the middle of the screen, just ripping through the entire thing. I'm like, that it works, but it also reminds me, we have a long way to go before this stuff is like perfect.
As kind of a kind of tangent to that. I think one thing that, like, I'm not going to say it was, like, necessarily wrong about, but I think the trajectory never got anywhere where I expected was dual screen phones, aka, you know, most notably the Surface Duo. And it's weird because I've been seeing the Surface Duo in, like, a couple shows that I've been watching recently, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. But I think there's still potential in the idea, but I think the initial launch of some of those devices was just so rocky that it kind of doomed that kind of idea from the start. And that's always been a little disappointing.
I mean, that's the Microsoft problem. It's the Microsoft problem, Sam, where they will have good ideas, but they don't have the follow through or the software talent. So it's like so much of the Surface stuff, cool ideas. I like them a lot, but then they'll put the slowest chip in them, you know, or they'll do something that makes us like be like, why would anybody buy this? So
Dev, I was going to say, you must have been at that that Microsoft event where they announced the Surface Duo, and there was another device they announced then, the Surface Neo, which was like a mini laptop, and that thing, I was waiting so patiently to try that thing out, and then it never materialized. And then talking about Windows, you know, Windows 10X, which was like, you know, an operating system designed around devices with dual screens, just, you know, that got canceled, and you know, that really changed the trajectory for those type of devices.
I think that really got folded. If you guys go back and read my way too long Windows 11 review, but Windows 10X is essentially got turned into Windows 11. Like that's basically what happened there. But I agree with you, Sam. The Surface Neo looked really cool. Microsoft just like slowly killed it off because I think the Duo did so badly. But this may be another example of Microsoft like, you know, swinging for where the puck is, where they're thinking foldable phones are going to be a big deal. But maybe they would have been better off not trying to chase phones because they have never been good at phones and trying to give us like a small pocketable, basically Windows tablet. You know, the Neo could be a really cool Windows tablet or a mini laptop when it needs to be. Such a cool concept. And now what we're seeing is rumors that Apple's thinking of whatever their first foldable is going to be. It could be something like the iPad mini that folds. And that is essentially what the Neo was. So again, Microsoft, you know, they love to create these visions of a digital journal, like the Courier 10 years ago.
I was going to say, it's like, it's so weird to see that cycle come around again, because we had the Courier way back in the day, which was basically the like earliest concept version of the Surface Duo.
I'm so annoyed. Don't make me think about like all the things Microsoft has messed up. Okay, anything around foldables? Because I think we should also talk about 5G, which actually launched and is a thing, but that was also kind of rocky too, right?
So I just want to say I like the small foldable form factor actually a lot more. I think that I was expecting 2019 for Motorola to bring back the Razr Flip with a flexible display. I mean, I was very disappointed by the first few iterations of it, but that style, I mean, I think Samsung's done it better perhaps. I am now just waiting to see how Google does it. I also want to say that I think Google did a pretty good job with the Pixel Fold this year. I gave a lot of props to people I see out in the real world using it. So, but yes, 5G. So I threw this in as a topic or something that I've observed change since, you know, 2019. I will tell you this, when I was, you know, hiding under the blankets recording this episode on, you know, for our relaunch, I still have faith in 5G.
That's really all you can have is faith in wireless
perception. Yeah, I was like, it's coming. Well, it's coming, y'all.
Hold on. What does that even mean? You have faith in like wireless transmission?
God damn you, Sam. Yeah. I bought into the hype, I think is what it's probably a bit more accurate. I was like, yeah, you know, it's going to be so fast. It's going to be great. Everything's going to be millimeter wave. And then here we are, 2023. You know, I was like, give it till 2020 for them to launch the first few ones. And then they did at the Olympics in Korea or whatever. And then like, now here we are. Sub 6 is the most prevalent. Millimeter wave who? And then also it's mid-band is the other most prevalent one because, again, the waves are just stronger. So I don't know. I just feel like in the years since, 5G has just been a bit of a letdown to me. It is here.
I mean, sure, Lynn. I've been covering 5G stuff since 2012. The first time I went to Mobile World Congress.
2012? Okay.
2012. Since the first time I went to Mobile World Congress. And listen, it's been a long, slow road to there. But you're right. We got to point out some of these things, right? Like sub-6 or the lower bandwidth there or lower band. But that's essentially like slightly faster 4G LTE. Like, that's what a lot of those speeds are. Ultra wideband, you know, the higher end stuff is what is really fast. I will say
that's millimeter wave.
Yeah, that's millimeter wave. Where I live outside of Atlanta, Atlanta itself was a big Verizon millimeter wave area. But even in the suburbs, I am now getting, you know, 5G ultra wideband. Like, when I'm sitting in parking lots and doing stuff, that's also how I was able to test.
Who's your carrier?
It's Verizon. That may be why. But yeah, not every carrier is offering it. It's sporadically available. But if you are in the sweet spot and they're slowly getting there, that's how I was able to play the PlayStation Portal in a parking lot because it was like decently fast enough. So some things are getting better. And I will say for a lot of people, just like having a video chat, right? Having a FaceTime video chat is more capable now, even if you're not on millimeter wave. So it's slowly getting better. It's not like life-changing, right?
I never thought I would see the day I hear Devendra defending 5G. But go ahead, Sam.
I think that's like one of the hard parts is that like there's so many like big tentpole like concepts, technologies like AI that, you know, there's this huge promise of, hey, it's going to change your life. It's going to change everything. And then you got to be – it's really important to be more realistic about the actual realities of what that is. And so – I just did a quick Google search. Mobile data speeds in July 2019 were about 27 Mbps. And now we're talking upwards of 100 Mbps, 150 Mbps. And so in 5 years, that's a pretty huge increase in terms of just like, hey, like you said, you want to do FaceTime calls, you want to watch videos on the go, maybe stream something from the cloud or something. And so does that change your life? Necessarily, no, but it makes it easier to do the things that you like to do when you're not at home. And there's also, you know, more edge cases in that, like, hey, if you are at a crowded, like, stadium, you know, the carriers are using millimeter wave 5G so that you can actually make a call or order a drink to your seat or something like that. And I think this is kind of like the maturation of, like, society as a whole, whereas, like, the technologies that we're getting aren't as, like, there's no more... we're going from a horse to a car moment, right? We're going from, you know, not having power to electricity or something like that. You know, we're not getting those like massive changes, but everything is more incremental and things are, you know, you have to pay attention to how these things progress over time.
Although I will say the rise of AI does seem like what if it's like replacing your horse with a car moment, like when done well, like it is like blowing minds for that, you know, for that reason. For our listeners, I would recommend one thing I like to do is download the speed test app on your phone. And whenever you're just walking around your neighborhood and you see like, oh, you're in 5G UWB in like a higher end 5G area, just run your speed test, see how it looks, see how things are changing and do that regularly. Yeah. Because you will notice like things are getting better. Yeah.
As a caveat, I will say that one of the reasons I still don't have that is because my carrier is T-Mobile. And T-Mobile, you know, doesn't have that build out. So if you're in Verizon, yes. And that's the other part of what I'm saying as like the 5G promise. Only one carrier in the U.S. has really implemented it. I mean, AT&T is also mid-band and sub-6, as is T-Mobile / Sprint.
But Sherlyn, all of T-Mobile's ads say it has the largest 5G network in the country.
Yes, because that's what I'm talking about. That's why I'm pissed off, right? Anyway, to Sam, something Sam said, though, that pinged me, like remind me of something also. He said, Sam, you mentioned something about incremental increases like over time as opposed to like one big generational leap each time. And I'm seeing that trend, and I also didn't think I would expect to see this maybe back in 2019 in software updates for like platforms like Android. We're not seeing Android do a big generational leap every new version. We're now seeing like Pixel feature drop or like Android feature drop every quarterly instead of annually. And then Apple seems to still be sticking to like annual updates, but I feel like that might change. I don't know. But I think it's fine. And I really think it's okay to like go to a more like frequent.
That's actually how software should be updated. Exactly. It's just like when something breaks, like you shouldn't have to wait till next year to get new stuff. We should probably mention a couple of other things just to because we gotta move on from this whole thing. One thing I want to mention real quick too is, hey, shortly after we started doing the podcast, we all had to go into lockdown. And we started making the podcast remotely. And I do think the COVID-19 pandemic has like reshifted the way people work. Work from home has become a big topic, hybrid work where people will work from home sometimes and then go into the office. Remote work is all like a big thing. That's changed a lot, hasn't it? Like the PC industry had a big wave of purchases because of that. People needed more computers in their homes or newer computers. Like
there was a time when you couldn't get a webcam basically all of 2020.
Couldn't get like a decent computer sometimes too. Like that was all changing because a lot of office workers, specifically knowledge workers, because frontline workers still had to go to work amid the pandemic, and that was just a terrible time. But knowledge workers at least like were able to shift a lot of their work remotely. And I think that's also reshaped the way people think of their work lives. I was a freelancer for a long time. You know, I left an office job to come to New York to write about technology, and I was a freelancer for over a year. But I also learned, like, man, I love being able to just go anywhere or do like work from the park or work from home and not being trapped in an office. And I think the pandemic time at least showed a lot of people that, oh, there are other ways to work. It showed companies that there are other ways to manage your employees too, even though a lot of them seem to be trying to step away from that. But I do think it's worth calling out, like, that was a big societal shift because you don't have this sort of like awakening among employees or among even companies, you know, without like the world forcing them to change somehow.
And for about a year now, we've been talking about RTO, return to office. My entirely non-expert opinion is that we are just at the 50% mark. We're at the halfway point of talking about whether or not companies are going to go fully remote or not. I think it's mostly because so many of these companies are still locked into their real estate obligations.
I think that's a lot of it. I'm right now sitting in Yahoo's office in New York City. We used to have three floors. Now we have one floor and everybody is like crammed in. So I think there's a lot of like consolidation happening, but also it's the flexibility. I think a lot of companies are now seeing like workers demand a certain amount of flexibility because a lot of work can be done remotely or your work can be done and then you can go home and take care of your kids or something. So it's a different way of living that I think it was worth calling out and is also enabled by a lot of tech too. So
for sure. I was going to say like the pandemic forced us as a society to realize how many jobs could be done remotely because they didn't have a choice. And now we're in that second phase of the thing. It's like, how many jobs should be done remotely?
Really quick, when you mentioned Yahoo, I just want to point out that Yahoo's our overall business owner. Like, Yahoo, Engadget's part of Yahoo. There you go. Just in case that confused you as to why the Avengers casually camping out at the Yahoo office.
Real quick, a couple other things we want to mention. There are also some like major changes in the way the PC industry itself is working. Like Apple shifted away from Intel's chips and toward its own hardware, which I think in itself was not too surprising because they've been making chips for the iPhone and iPad forever. Makes sense that they push that to Macs. What was surprising is that, holy crap, their chips are so fast. And they also did the magical work that Microsoft never seems to be able to do, of like reorienting their entire operating system around this new architecture, having emulation that works really well for older apps too. So when I reviewed the first MacBook Air with the M1 chip, it ran Intel, like it ran older apps through Rosetta 2 faster than most laptop PCs, you know, or most Windows PCs. So that was surprising. That thing also didn't have a fan. So Apple's chips were just like a huge leap forward in terms of efficiency and also power and what you can expect from a laptop chip. I'm still like amazed every time I benchmark those things. Intel and AMD have slowly caught up, but their solution has basically been, let's pump more power into these chips. Like, let's just draw more heat. Let's raise clock speeds. And that is the complete opposite path Apple took by moving to their own mobile chips rather than the, like, big PC-sized chips. So that's notable. And we're also seeing the rise of like AI chips and stuff too. Apple's chips had neural processing units, which powered a lot of the AI stuff. Intel is finally releasing their Meteor Lake chips this year, which will also have MPUs. AMD did that last year, and they're redoing that this year. We'll talk a little bit about that. So the entire like PC market is kind of shifting a bit, but I think Apple just really shook everything up. Apple really kicked Intel in the pants with their chips, and you know, it's notable. I'm still shocked at like how well those computers run.
I want to touch on that just super quickly, because it really highlights the sort of bigger power balance between just x86 and ARM as a whole. And even in terms of just like technology design, it was happening before that, but it's really started accelerating recently, where we're going to start designing devices for mobile first and having the, you know, maybe the desktop systems take a back seat. And so that's been a definite shift that we've seen in recent times.
I mean, it was happening before with like Qualcomm, right? Qualcomm would produce chips and put them in Windows laptops, and every time I think of it, I just get so angry, because every one of those computers, I just want to throw out the window. Right, Sherlyn? You've reviewed some of those.
It's literally the thing I was about to interrupt to say, which is that like I have kind of in a sick way, I enjoy watching Qualcomm disappear into the background, if anything, because we've also concurrently seen companies like Apple and Google and Samsung all grow to rely on their own chips more in the smartphone side of things. And that's been weirdly satisfying. Just, I mean, like, you know, nothing wrong with Qualcomm, really, but having these companies be able to own their own verticals a bit has been like also an interesting development in my mind. I am also a little bit pissed about the whole Windows on Snapdragon promise not coming true.
I'm still so mad at that. Go read some of Sherlyn's reviews of the Surface Pro X. Go read my review of the Surface Pro. What was it? The 9? Well, wherever the last one was that was 5G, which was such a freaking lie. Yeah.
Oh, of course, you know, now we got to revisit this topic, because now Qualcomm has their new Orion Core processor. And so, you know, that could change things. Maybe not.
They do this every year. They're like, our next chipset with all these features are going to change everything. And I'm like, I can't believe you anymore, Qualcomm. You've lied to me too many times. Sherlyn, is there anything you want to call out in terms of accessibility changes? Because we've seen things like the game controllers from Xbox and, you know, PlayStation hit. So those are interesting.
I just want to say that I think in 2019, again, at the start, I wasn't aware I was going to start focusing on accessibility coverage. I just didn't know. So once I started, though, not to say that I'm the cause of anything, I just think that more and more companies have been more and more aware of the need for inclusive design, of more assistive tech. And so we've been seeing a lot more developments. I mean, Apple's always kind of been at the forefront, always, you know, building some of its software out to make sure it's inclusive and accessible. But I'm seeing more companies, Microsoft has been a lot louder about its accessibility efforts. And Google has then followed suit. And you've got then the trickle-down effect of companies like Amazon and other companies talking about their accessibility efforts. I think that's going to be a good thing overall, and it's been very heartening for me to see and report on over the years.
Excellent. Yeah, and I mean, I don't think that's slowing down is the thing, too. I think companies are finally paying attention to accessibility and noticing that there are more journalists who are also focusing on these products, too, and getting their voices out there, and I think that's super important, because they're showing like different sorts of people are using this technology, and it needs to be inclusive. Like, that's the ultimate thing. Like, tech gets better if it brings everybody in. I want to mention we've had some really great guests on. So I want to redirect you listeners to some that you may have missed. Sherlyn, you had a great episode with Dr. Nerdlove.
No, I mean, that was a fun episode that had like nothing really to do with gadgets. We were all just like having a holiday situation where like, you know, it felt like people around us.
He is great with advice. I've always liked advice columnists. I think he is a good like person for younger generations that's not like, you know, who are the older ones? Like there are people that have been in newspapers forever, you know, but I think he is a cool dude. We talked with Michio Kaku, who is a physicist and, you know, professor that I've been reading his work since I was in high school. That was a fun chat. But I also want to shout out, like, we had some really great interviews with folks like Bill Nye, the science guy. Sherlyn,
that was my favorite. I'm sorry. This is my favorite episode.
It was so good. Even though Bill Nye's internet was not working so well. So we had to like fight that. We were on a live stream helping him troubleshoot his internet at the same time. It was a whole thing. But first of all, Sherlyn, you brought in Bill Nye as a guest. So good job. Congrats.
Thank you. Yeah. No, it still lives on our YouTube if y'all ever want to go back and look it up. Sam, I don't know if you were working with Engadget at the time, but it was like one of my most exciting moments in this career ever. And Bill Nye had a moment where he just pauses and he's like answering a question. Midway through the question, he goes, "And so if we were able to do all this, Sherlyn," and I was like, "Oh my God, he said my name." You can watch back on the live stream on the video how my face, like my face just froze.
You wrote up a lot of that stuff, Sherlyn, in a piece called Bill Nye's Pissed Off or something like that. So that was, I think the main takeaway from that interview is like he is so sick of this shit. Like he is so sick of the oil industry and politicians and people kind of like denying climate change and not doing anything about it. So here's just a tidbit. Here's a clip of Bill Nye talking about why he thinks climate change is such an important topic right now.
But everybody, we have to stop burning fossil fuels. This is not rocketry. Mm-hmm. We just have to stop this. And so I just point out to everybody that the same places where we are extracting oil and natural gas are the same areas in North America where we have huge wind resources and solar resources. My goodness, you know.
Yeah.
A dear friend of mine went to the University of Nebraska. And even now, 40 years later, she just curses the wind. It just blows all the time. So let's use it. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then people say, well, we don't have any way to store it. Well, let's figure one out. Okay.
Yeah.
We also talked with Anne Droyan, the wife of Carl Sagan. And she, you know, she did a lot of work with him. She co-wrote Cosmos with him, I believe. We talked with her around a new series that she's kicking off. And I think she has also a lot to say about the state of the world and why it's important that we're focusing on topics like climate change.
That's what inspires me, because it gives me the sense that we can do this, mm-hmm. that we have what it takes, that there are those among us capable of such discipline and vision and understanding and strength and unselfishness. That we can get through this period of our technological adolescence when we have been given very powerful toys to play with, mm-hmm. but we've yet to adopt the wisdom and to internalize the wisdom necessary for anyone who would toy with such powers.
So that clip, you know, she was talking about like our capability for greatness and to do things. We could read that into AI. We could read that into the tech we can use to hopefully help solve climate change, or at least help prevent things from getting worse. So that was a great chat. And there's going to be a little clip from her later on that I think is going to wrap up like why I think that was such a fun, hopeful conversation. Those are some of our favorite guests. Go back, check it out. If you subscribe to our feed, you can just access them pretty easily. The live streams are all available on our YouTube channel. And yeah, Sherlyn, any thoughts on all this?
I mean, I think what I like also about having done this podcast and all these different interviews that we've done over the years, there's quite a breadth of things we've been able to do. We've had a lot of fun. We've had a live stream. I really miss it. I never imagined all the different ways we could go, all the different topics we could cover. So if there's any, I think if you listening right now, if there's any episode you really liked that we didn't bring up, or if you have any, like, what was your favorite thing that changed in the last, you know, since fall of 2019? Definitely send it to us, podcast@engadget.com.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us on this chat. Where can people find you online these days?
Absolutely. As always, you can find me on engadget.com and on the site that shall be named, at Sam Rutherford.
All let's move on to some other news. Literally the day after our last recording, there was some Friday news. I'm sure you all heard about it. We covered it in Gadget. But Sam Altman was fired from OpenAI by the board. So let me just quickly move through those beats. Sam Altman was fired. One of his co-founders followed him. There was a lot of drama over the weekend over what was happening because it was very unclear. OpenAI's board even picked on, they picked a CEO to replace him. Well, they brought over the CTO from OpenAI as interim CEO. They brought in one of the co-founders of Twitch to eventually be the CEO. There's a lot of drama. Microsoft, apparently, Satya Nadella in particular, was surprised by this news, like all of us, and was very pissed and was making some very public overtures. As of the next week, Nadella had invited Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, or the former CEO, to join Microsoft, and had invited a lot of people from OpenAI to do that as well. Ultimately, what happened was Sam Altman was reinstated as the CEO of OpenAI. The people that followed him, Brockman, I believe, is back in his role. The board has been reshifted. Notably, there are no longer any women on the OpenAI board. And among the people on the early board, those were the folks trying to push him out. The information we have around why they were doing that is kind of unclear. The board said that they couldn't trust what he was saying. There are reports that Sam Altman was basically shoved out of Y Combinator 2 for basically self-dealing for other things too. So there's a lot going on that we don't know. But the weird thing is, fast forward a week and essentially Sam Altman's back in OpenAI. Microsoft is now even tighter knit to OpenAI because recently they announced that they're joining the board in a non-voting role. And essentially what all this means is that a lot of the voices at OpenAI that could push back against what Sam Altman was doing are gone. They're no longer part of the board. Sam, it's a weird thing because OpenAI, I don't know if you remember this, Sherlyn, it started as a nonprofit organization co-founded by Sam Altman, Elon Musk, a whole bunch of folks to stop bad AI. That was their whole goal, to stop bad AGI. And it was a nonprofit. They formed a for-profit arm that was profit capped, so they could only make so much, a certain amount of money. That is what ended up licensing ChatGPT and other things to Microsoft. Microsoft invested a lot, is a minority stake investor in OpenAI. They have one of the weirdest corporate diagrams I have ever seen. But basically, OpenAI was always supposed to be a nonprofit that's against the super hyper-capitalist proliferation of AI. But it seems like Sam Altman, that's what he was doing. And people were pissed about that. Do you have any thoughts about this whole thing at this point?
I just found it funny that yesterday, December 6th, a Business Insider report came out that said OpenAI employees really, really did not want to go work for Microsoft. And that during the chaos after Sam Altman was ousted, Microsoft offered to hire the CEO and its entire workforce. And that insiders now say it was a bluff that worked.
That was definitely a bluff, yeah.
But one of the quotes that one of our coworkers mentioned in our team Slack in discussing this article was that, quote, even though we have a partnership with Microsoft, internally we have no respect for their talent bar, apparently a current OpenAI employee told Business Insider.
And they would have lost a lot of money too, right, if they went over to Microsoft.
They would have. Abandoning OpenAI would have meant losing out on lucrative pay, equity, and a rich tender offer, according to the article as well. So there's a lot going on there. I think there's a lot of Silicon Valley sort of discourse around OpenAI, Microsoft, and all of that stuff that is, amusing from a distance to me. I do think that we're watching, what was meant to be sort of this altruistic or at least this nonprofit organization become the way it has is kind of intriguing to watch, but not unexpected, if that makes sense.
It's kind of a defining moment for AI too, because the thing about OpenAI is the people fighting against the proliferation of AI are basically doomers. They're basically the people thinking that AGI or artificial general intelligence could destroy humanity. So they want to build it first so they could control it. There aren't really any sane people. There aren't people who are this could be an interesting thing, but let's just take a step back. There's very two extremes. There's people who want to push AI as fast as possible to make as much money. And there are the people who want to keep it back a little bit because they're worried AI will destroy the world. There's no middle ground at OpenAI, which is a weird, I don't know, just a weird position for a company. But anyway, now Sam Altman is Time's CEO of the year after all that drama. So great. Great. Good job. Good job. But yeah, it is a weird thing that we weren't able to. This is news that has happened in the past 2 weeks.
We couldn't cover it. As it was, yeah.
But if you want to relive the drama with me, I ended up hosting This Week in Tech right after that whole weekend, like as this was all going on. So if you want to hear me, Alex Lindsay, Paris Martineau, and Anthony Ha, who was a guest on this show, if you want to hear us talk about just what it was like to be following tech news that weekend, we even we actually kept that show going for 3 hours because there was an 8 p.m. deadline to see if the board would like come to an agreement with Sam Altman. So we kind of just sat there and wait to like see if we could report live news. Didn't end up happening, but it was a fun conversation. So you can relive that whole drama there with us. Speaking of AI stuff, by the way, Google had a big thing, right, Sherlyn?
This week, Google announced that it has something called Gemini, which is its answer to ChatGPT-4, I believe. And basically, it's come up with basically a name, I guess, for its platform, its AI platform, and its model anyway, right? It's this new AI model. And to quote the news release, the company, this is Gemini, is the most capable model we've ever built. It plans to incorporate Gemini across its product platforms, starting with Bard, and it'll go into Android phones, I believe. It is the result of collaboration between Google's DeepMind and its research divisions. So it has, quote, it has like a bunch of, you know, bells and whistles that generative AIs have to offer. Sundar Pichai in a statement said that its capabilities are state of the art in nearly every domain. So it's supposed to be like this super advanced model.
I mean, one interesting thing, Andy Tarantola wrote this up at Engadget. This is a multimodal AI, like from the start. So with Bard, they eventually add the ability to drop in an image or something or drop in other things for it to like produce queries, and this one can accept all sorts of media from the beginning. It's going to be very smart. So if Bard is disappointing to you now, maybe it'll get better, right?
It could. Bard could get better. Here's the thing. Gemini, one thing I found quite fun, interesting that Andy pointed out, Gemini can code as well. It's reportedly proficient in programming languages like Python, Java, C++, and Go. I know all of those, but Go. Actually, I don't know Java very well.
Wow. Okay.
But I've also been
Sterling, but okay, thanks for sharing.
I know. I've been lurking enough in like programmer humor subreddits to know that thinking about AI as coding on your behalf is just a joke right now because the codes that they've come up with have been really dumb or very implausible. But you know, apparently it can. And it's more versatile. It's clearly be able to like more at least seems from this announcement to be able to do a lot more. So it's like what we just talked about, right? Like AI has come a long way and it's about to go even further, and this is seeming to lay the foundation. So
it's also going to be available in 3 sizes. I think it's worth pointing out there's going to be a nano, pro, and ultra size of Gemini, and nano should be something that fits in like, you know, your phone, right? On device tasks. Ultra will be something in the cloud powered by dozens, hundreds of GPUs that can do much, much more complex tasks. So this whole market is heating up. Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to mention about Gemini really quickly is what does this mean to you listening? Maybe you're a consumer. Well, if you have a Pixel phone, in fact, if you bought the Pixel 8 Pro, Gemini is actually in it. The Pixel 8 Pro is the first smartphone, according to Google, engineered to run Gemini Nano, which is one of those sizes that you mentioned. And it powers features like Summarize in the Recorder app, which we did cover when we talked about the Pixel 8 Pro's launch. And it's also rolling out in Smart Reply in Gboard. It will start in WhatsApp. So, you know, when companies are a little like mysterious with their language and their wording during pre-briefs, you kind of have a sense that something else is coming. So when Google was like, oh yeah, we can't talk about the availability of Summarize in the Recorder app yet, but we can demo this to you at this hands-on, I'm like, oh, something else is coming. And this is what was coming. I think, you know, Google wanted to launch Gemini together with all of the other areas that it's going to be available, including Gemini will also be available in Search, Ads, Chrome, Duet AI, which is the suite of G Suite type of things where Gen AI is available. And then Search Generative Experience is also where Gemini is being experimented right now with, according to Google, a 40% reduction in latency alongside improvements in quality.
That's a lot of things. And also in other news, we saw a bunch of things from Microsoft. They announced some upgrades coming to Copilot. It's going to be powered eventually by OpenAI's GPT-4 Turbo, which is a slightly newer version of that model, and also DALL-E 3. So that's the better image generation. AMD also officially announced their Ryzen 8040 chips, which have built-in MPUs. And it's notable, we mentioned this before, but AMD last year unveiled the Ryzen 7000 chips. One of those had an MPU built in. The MPU is the AI, you know, little processor. It's the thing that can do the Windows Studio effects, and not every processor has them. But now AMD is bringing it to a much larger part of its portfolio. Intel next week is going to be launching its Core Ultra chips, basically the Meteor Lake chips, which also have MPUs. So next year, you can expect like more laptops are going to have AI processing. AI PC is the new buzzword a lot of these companies are talking about. It's a thing. AI is going everywhere. And, you know, Intel has talked about how it's worked together with Audacity and other software makers to implement things, features that actually take advantage of AI. So, you know, that's totally happening. Even if you're not using generative AI, these companies are definitely thinking of ways to use these capabilities. So keep an eye out, folks. Sherlyn, did you see this news about government spying on our push notifications?
I saw Apple sort of like wouldn't admit it or something. But then somewhere someone did.
Senator Ron Wyden, in a letter to the Department of Justice, was demanding data from Alphabet, Google, basically, and Apple about the surveillance the governments were doing. So specifically, they're talking about push notifications, which are those, you know, alerts you get at the, you know, at the top of your phone or in your like notifications tray. These go through Apple and Google servers and are not like fully encrypted. They're not as secure as the data on your device. And it seems like foreign governments and also the U.S. government have been keeping an eye on this stuff to just track people. Like, you can get a lot of information if you're just looking at somebody's notifications, right? And Apple says that they were barred from talking about this by the Department of Defense. Yet another way.
Shady.
Really shady. Do you have any other thoughts on that, Sherlyn? It's just a thing. We're getting more information on this. There is basically just Ron Wyden's letter at this point. But it seems we're going to hear more about the surveillance at some point.
My main takeaway is the same as it's always been when we talk about stuff like that, is that I always just assume I'm being surveilled. And I'm like, all right, you want to check out my dank memes? Check out my dank memes. Or I don't know.
I mean, well, specifically, this one's like, Sherlyn's getting a lot of like notifications from Grubhub. Is she just like out there just like ordering delivery every day? What is happening with this girl? I don't know.
It's really Reddit suggesting things to me all day, every day now. It's just, yet another AITA post that you should read.
Those are so damn addictive. But yeah, Wyden's letter, he basically asked the Department of Justice to repeal or modify any policies that hindered public discussions of push notification spying, according to Reuters. Apple said that Wyden's letter gave them the opening they needed to share more details about this. And Google, you know, I believe they are going to list the amount of requests they're getting from governments and the U.S. government about getting this sort of push notification information. So something's happening. We don't know quite what yet, but hey, yeah, governments are spying on your push notifications. Keep an eye out. Also, in other news, we saw from Mr. Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg that Apple is readying some new iPads, an M3 MacBook Air for early next year, larger iPhones. And new AirPods also coming in 2024. I don't know what he means by larger iPods or iPhones, though. Like, how much larger can we get? Unless we're talking about a foldable iPhone.
Maybe larger screens, even larger screens with smaller, but I don't know.
I don't know. The rumor, I mentioned this before, but the rumor of like an Apple foldable could be something like the iPad mini, which is a 7-incher, I believe. It's a pretty like a device around 7 inches, certainly slightly bigger than the iPhone Pro Max. So we will see some stuff, but basically expect some new hardware from Apple next year. I know people have been waiting for the M3 MacBook Air, so I still think the M2 model is a really good deal. If you see any sales on it, go for it. But that M3 one will have some new capabilities too, at least from what we've seen the M3 MacBook Pro. There was also something Apple related you wanted to shout out too, right, Sherlyn?
Yeah, so last Sunday, December 3rd, was the International Day of the Persons with Disabilities, and slightly ahead of that, so a couple of days before that, Apple released a new video, like it always does around this time this year, a short film. And this one highlighted its new accessibility feature called Personal Voice, as well as another new feature called Live Speech. And this video really has a sort of Where the Wild Things Are vibe to it, kind of. It's not much of a spoiler. It's a short video, but it is a person that is narrating a story or reading a bedtime story to a kid. And this person is not using their own voice to do it, but they're using their personal voice and using the iPhone's live speech tool to narrate and converse with this child. But at the start of the show, you don't actually know that's what's happening. You're just seeing this, children's story play out with the narration in the background. This film was actually directed by Taika Waititi. Pretty cool. I liked it a lot. And I also appreciate, I think every time Apple has done this in the past, it does get a lot of eyes. It catches a lot of attention, gets a lot of, people talking about some of these accessibility features. And this one, to me, was pretty moving. It's just a very sweet story, directed very well, beautiful visuals. And in tandem, too, Apple released the children's storybook through Apple Books as an ebook, and it's available for free. So if you have an iPhone at all or any iOS device, really, just go get it. It's a free ebook. It's got beautiful illustrations. You might as well. You can read it to children if you want. You can keep it around for yourself. But I thought that was a fun, little piece of news that broke last week.
Can you talk about what the personal voice stuff actually is?
So personal voice is a feature where you can use, an iOS 17, iPadOS 17, or macOS Sonoma device with Apple Silicon to save a copy of your voice. And this, is more for people who are at risk of permanent voice loss, which can happen with conditions like ALS, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, or vocal cord paralysis. You can record a copy of your voice while you're able and then use it to converse with people so that you're not using a tool like Live Speech, for example, which you can type words into it and it can read it out for you, right? When you're using that, currently, it tends to be one of a few generic computerized voices. It's not your own voice. So when you're suffering from a condition like that, or when you're going through a condition like that, you're already going through so much. Losing your voice can feel really like losing yet another part of your identity or another part of yourself. Like, you already feel like your entire body's turning against you, I think. Why now, just to feel like another part of you is slipping away, can really feel very, just traumatic, actually. So I think, having this feature and this ability to save your voice is really a nice touch. So I wrote an article right after Apple's video went up, just kind of walking through the process of how to set it up and also just my impressions of the voice overall. In fact, what do you think of me using my voice to say something for this podcast?
Go for it. Go for it. Let's hear what Sherlyn's personal voice sounds like from her iPhone.
Hello, Devendra and Ben. I am hungry. I am taking a poop.
Just like the real Sherlyn.
Bloody hell, y'all. I am a monster. Okay, last one.
And that's over. Okay, I'm back. I mean, you can probably tell. It sounds more like me, for sure. Like, if you heard that, you would think it's me, but like awkward, stilted me. It took me about 20 minutes to record everything, and then took the phone several hours to produce a voice, which is all happening on device. So you can hopefully assure that your voice, if you have your voice print somewhere as your sign in or something, it should be harder to try to, attack or get that. Yeah. But yeah.
So it's building an AI model exactly. of your voice in yeah. those hours. That's yeah. what's it's happening.
On
That's
device, cool. neural net training and creating the models to use your voice as a language or a voice model for the live speech tool. So if you're curious, I mean, it's available to anyone on iOS. You don't need to be at risk of voice loss to set it up, right? So if you want to, like I did, you can. Well, I think it's a nice touch. So it's really fun to see. Other than that, though, for other stuff that I've been working on this week, I've been, just heads down on end of year stuff, by the way. And I need people to help me with my work. And this is one time people can actually help me with my work. If you have any ideas on who are the big winners and losers in tech this year, you send them to me at podcast@engadget.com or Sherlyn@engadget.com. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's cool to hear Robot Sherlyn at least working in real time. It also goes to when we talk about Apple working really well with accessibility stuff. This is another one I think. another one of those things I think is like really genuinely useful to people. So cool to see. Want to show a couple of things I'm working on. I'm in town right now. I'm in New York doing some CES meetings. Also have some laptop reviews in the works ahead of CES. So we're all just like dealing with end of year stuff. We're dealing with CES prep. Thankfully, CES is the second week of January, or at least a little later. It's not like immediately January 2nd or 3rd like it used to be. So we have a little bit of breathing time after, you know, New Year's. But yeah, folks, we are gearing up for that. Also, like in part of my brain too, I'm also planning for Sundance, which is going to be happening pretty much right after CES. So that's going to be a fun time. It's that time of year. You know, we're thinking about where we've been and next. So yeah, gadget.com. Let us know, folks, if there's anything else like you are, I know, looking forward to, or any other highlights that you've had from the year. Sherlyn, are there any pop culture picks for us this week?
Yeah, so there's three sort of shouts that are not necessarily picks and then one definite pick. So I saw Napoleon, the movie. It was fine. If you want to watch it, go. It's fine. It's just fine. And then this piece of news reminded me, this piece of news that happened this week reminded me of something else that I saw. So Netflix has renewed the Squid Game reality show for a second season. I saw the reality show, like the first few episodes of it. It was disgusting. I could not.
It's really bad. Yeah.
It's just disgusting because I'm not into like sensory, like sounds. Like there's an episode, like one of the challenges, they have to lick a thing and there's just a lot of people licking a thing. And I'm just like, gross, gross, gross. So I didn't enjoy it as much as the actual TV show. The reality show is just not as fun. The people suck. You just don't like the people.
Also, it is a capitalist like game show through,
but brought, you know, to the real world and not fictionalized.
Squid Games was doing about how bad that stuff is. It's weird.
So and then one more show I saw. I don't know if some of you have followed my Instagram. You might notice that Chris Velasco, our former Engadget coworkers and current persona non grata, he was in town and we caught up. And he suggested that me and some of our friends we were hanging out with watch this movie called Love on a Leash. And if you've seen The Room, you know what to expect. It's basically a really crap movie that I thought, for the most part, I thought it was like this some high school kids film project or something. But it is so bad in a way that like is quite enjoyable if you're with some friends and you're ready to be like, what is logic? Enjoy that. It's really great. And then finally, my actual pick is I discovered something on Hulu recently. I don't know if you've heard of this show, Devendra. Dimension 404.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's got like quite a, like it's an episodic, almost anthologic kind of a show. Like a mix, I would describe it as a mix of like Twilight Zone meets Black Mirror, almost. Every episode is a tight, like, I don't know, want to say 40 something minutes. The first episode is about a dating service. It stars Joel McHale. And then there's other episodes where it includes people like Patton Oswalt's in there. Sarah Hyland is in one of the episodes as well. Just a lot of like a really shockingly A-list cast, actually. Oh, maybe not A-list, maybe like B or C-list, but you know, well-known names. And they're like, you know, not super highly produced to the point of like Black Mirror, but every episode has a very interesting premise and sits squarely within Engadget's scope of like, you know, the word 404 comes from that error 404 not found, right? So it is all about sort of that sort of stuff, like tech-related mishaps and interesting tales. So if you're looking for that, there you go. I quite enjoyed it, I would say.
That's cool. Thank you for sharing, Sherlyn. I got a couple of things. I actually think you will like all of them. So I had Sherlyn in mind for this, but also our listeners. I think everybody will enjoy this. The movie May December, which is on Netflix right now, I think is one of my favorite films of the year. It's directed by Todd Haynes, stars Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore. And it's a weird, twisty movie, but I like complex dramas. And this is sort of like a retelling of the Mary Kay Letourneau story. The teacher, I believe, or the woman who famously, you know, had an affair with her student or a child. He was 13 years old. That's child sexual assault. That's what that story was. And that was in the tabloids for a while. This movie is about an actor coming to, you know, somebody who went through that same sort of tabloid drama because they're going to play her in a movie. Julianne Moore is the actual, you know, person who went through the drama. And Natalie Portman's the actor who's trying to play her. It is a weird, twisty movie that kind of explores what the impact of that would be on a relationship. But, you know, if that child and that adult got married and had a whole family, what is that relationship dynamic like? What is it kind of what does it mean? And also, who is the sort of person who would even do this thing? How do they justify it to themselves? It is a twisty movie. It's really funny at times, but also really, like, I don't know, just like really heartfelt too. Like, it is a lot. And I will also shout out Mr. Charles Melton, who I think most people will know him from Riverdale. He was like one of the hot young jocks who were sometimes a villain in Riverdale. He plays basically the victim in this story, the person who was a 13-year-old who was assaulted by a 35-year-old and has basically grown up and started a family with him. It is a weird movie, but it was also so complex and so interesting. I think as a drama, Sherlyn, like also as like just a showcase for acting for Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman and Charles Melton, like I think you will adore this movie. I've seen it 3 times now. I cannot stop thinking about it. I saw it with my wife. My parents also saw it too because I recommended it to them. It is very good. It's on Netflix right now, and I think it's one of the best movies of the year. I will tell you, folks, I have spent basically the past 2 weeks just mainlining piles of screeners that get sent to my house because I'm a part of a critics circle, and I do, you know, podcast reviews for my movie podcast. So there's a lot of stuff. I've seen so much stuff. I'm just giving you a few choice highlights here. But I have basically been in movie watching mode because that's what I do at the end of the year. Another thing I'd recommend to you, Sherlyn, is Godzilla Minus One. Have you heard about this?
This is more up my alley, it sounds like.
I mean, I think they're both up your alley. But this is the new Toho, you know, Japanese Godzilla film that's set right at the tail end of World War II. It's sort of like one of the first appearances of Godzilla because it's technically set before the first movie, before the first Gojira movie. It is an incredibly well-made disaster movie focusing on a kamikaze pilot who did not go through his mission. He has a bit of like survivor's guilt, but also Godzilla appears and messes stuff up. And it's also about a society trying to reconcile with the ending of the war and, you know, what the government forced a lot of citizens to do. It's a really great film, really great large-scale action. Also, Godzilla is terrifying in this one. So it's not like one of the fun, campy Godzillas. It is very much kind of a soap opera at times, but also really, really well done. So Godzilla Minus One, that's in theaters right now. And something a little different for you, Sherlyn, is you want a little rom-com? You want a little fun time? I would recommend Colin from Accounts for you. This is an Australian romantic comedy. It's streaming right now on Paramount Plus. Okay. Kind of a weird thing.
Oh, no, not Paramount Plus.
It's Paramount Plus, so I don't know if you have that. But it's similar to, like, Catastrophe and a lot of the, like, more irreverent romantic comedies that came out recently about people who aren't so great but inexplicably end up, like, you know, forming some sort of bond. It basically starts with a woman flashing a guy while she's walking down the street. He gets distracted. He runs over a dog. And they kind of take responsibility. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess we sort of, because of our actions, this poor dog has been hurt. And that is the beginning. They take the dog to the vet and they're sort of like bonded together because they decide, okay, they're not going to put this thing down. They're going to spend a lot of money to put this doggy, you know, on wheels, basically, and to take care of him. And that is the beginning of this rom-com. It's a very like sitcom-y setup. But, you know, the girl is like a 29-year-old medical student. She's working in a hospital. The guy is like 40-something, running a brewery. Probably different phases of their lives, but they are similarly kind of lost in having relationship issues. I think it's really funny. It's really, it can be really crass at times. So I think Sherlyn will enjoy that too. There is poop humor. There is poop humor. There is like a lot of like very explicit stuff as Australians love to do. But I also think it's really sweet at times too and genuinely funny. So that's Colin from Accounts. And the title will be explained to you if you watch the first episode. I won't spoil what that is, but it's really good. It's really funny. And, you know, you want to take a little vacation to Australia.
Where in Australia? Melbourne, Sydney?
It's set in Sydney. It looks like, honestly, any other city, but the weather looks very nice. Like, right now, we're dealing with winter temperatures, so it's like a nice little vacation to me.
I love it.
Yeah, so I think you'll enjoy it, Sherlyn. And also, there's a dog. It's a cute dog. Doggy on wheels. It's fun.
Well, that's it again for our episode this week. Thank you for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Mastodon and Blue Sky and everywhere. And I talk about movies at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me your favorite of our podcast moments or my most inappropriate remarks ever, or yours, you can send them to me on X because I don't check it anymore. I'm at Sherlyn Lowe there. No, I am. Send me your sincere thoughts on Threads. I am at Sherlynstagram, or just email me at Sherlyn@Engadget.com. Email us your thoughts and feedback at podcast@Engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts.
You know, as Carl and I wrote earlier, we humans are capable of greatness. We all live in the long shadow of climate change and other environmental depredation. But I believe that we can get to a much better future. And I think the key to that is taking what science is telling us to heart, not keeping it as just a collection of amazing facts that you compartmentalize and experience maybe for a couple of minutes or during a class, but instead a way of seeing absolutely everything.